Just call it old-style nation-building in Afghanistan.
It's a place of warring tribes, which is to say, a land of opportunity for such as we, who know how to train men and lead them into battle.
We'll go there. We'll say to any chief we can find, do you want to vanquish your foes? Of course, you'll say. Go to it. We'll fight for him, make him king, then we'll subvert that king. We'll seize his royal throne and loot the country four ways from Sunday.
How's that for a plan?
The new plan for Afghanistan is today's election. Afghans go to the polls to try and establish the first democratic continuity in the nation's history. But the conduct of the election itself could derail the plan. The men and women who would be kingmakers, NATO, the U.S., and the Taliban.
It's a place of warring tribes, which is to say, a land of opportunity for such as we.
The future of Afghanistan begins now on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Thursday, August 20th. I'm John Hockenberry, back here with Amy Holmes.
Good morning, John. Great to have you back. Coming up this hour, will the latest wave of violence in Baghdad change the plans for U.S. troops? Plus, tips on starting a small business in the recession.
But first, Charles Sennett, executive editor and vice president of Global Post, longtime journalist in South Asia, joins us. With all the candidates running in Afghanistan, Charles, is anyone running on a peace in our time platform, an end to the bombing, end to drone strikes, etc.?
There are none of the once and future kings who I know who are running on peace platforms. But probably the person who's sort of emerging as possibly benefiting from all that is unfolding in Kabul today would be Abdullah Abdullah, who was the former foreign minister, because voter turnout is strongest in the north, where he is the strongest, and his big issue is transparency.
Well, we're going to talk about that, get a profile of Abdullah Abdullah from Charles Sennett, executive editor and vice president of Global Post, in just a moment. But first, everything else you need to know this morning, Amy.
Well, here's what you need to know, John. In the headlines, there's more from Afghanistan. Election officials say they're extending voting by 1 hour today. That's about half an hour from now. Some polls already closed following militant attacks. Reports from the ground say voter turnout has been low in parts of the country. The U.S. deficit could be smaller than expected, but it'll still be a record breaker. The White House is set to reduce its deficit predictions by a couple hundred billion dollars to $1.6 trillion. That's because the White House isn't handing out as much bailout cash to banks as it predicted.
Iraq's Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki is blaming Sunni insurgents for the series of deadly bombings that killed more than 100 yesterday. Another Baghdad bombing killed two more today. Our partner, The New York Times, reports that the CIA hired Blackwater contractors for a secret program to assassinate top al-Qaeda operatives. It started in 2004. Government officials say no assassinations were actually carried out, and the program was shut down in June. New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson meets with North Korean diplomats again today. After meetings yesterday, Richardson said the North Koreans feel they're owed some kind of political gesture for the return of those two American journalists. Markets up slightly yesterday. The Dow opens today at 9279. The S&P starts trading at 996. And 1969 is the number for the NASDAQ as it gets going. A flat to positive opening, according to the futures trading. We're in the middle of a recession, but opening a business might just be a great bet. Revlon was started in the worst moment of the Depression back in 1932. Have you recently opened up a new business, or are you taking other risks? Is there an opportunity here? Tell us at 8778-MYTAKE or send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Amy Holmes, and we're talking about the Afghanistan. The polls are open in Afghanistan. They were expected to be closed by now, but authorities are actually keeping them open for an extra hour, a sign of perhaps the robustness of the voting process or the concern about the Taliban wanting to disrupt the voting and keep people from going to the polls. Perhaps the extension will get more people to the polls because every vote counts in Afghanistan. Here's a voter speaking in Kabul.
You had to vote. And I know there's a lot of concerns all over the country. But this morning I thought I have to go, no matter what happens. I'm feeling hopeful. Despite all the difficulty we have, we might be able to turn this country around. And by coming to vote, we are hoping for a better future.
one of a number of voter voices obtained by our partners at the BBC from Kabul this morning. The contenders in the current election, President Hamid Karzai, of course, the front runner, one of 30 official candidates on the ballot. His top challenger is his former foreign minister, Abdullah Abdullah. And speaking about Abdullah Abdullah, was longtime foreign correspondent and someone who's actually spent a lot of time covering this election campaign itself. Charles Sennett, who spoke with us at the top of the hour, he's executive editor and vice president of Global Post, a web-based international news organization. But Charles, first of all, how can you track this election using web sources and web information channels that you've managed to put in place anticipating this day?
Well, one thing we have is an excellent correspondent on the ground, Jean McKenzie. She's based for Global Post in Kabul, and she's very much in touch with aspiring young journalists in Afghanistan who are in many corners of the country. And we're able to track what's going on in large measure through her network of contacts. Also, it's really important to point out that Afghanistan has this nascent media movement that is really taking off, and journalists are getting better and stronger, and it is one of the great signs of weaknesses and fault lines running through this election is that the government, the central government, Karzai's government, cracked down on the media and has been preventing them from reporting on the violence that led up to it. So there's another sort of subplot to this election, which is the free press. And that's not right. That's not winning in this election. That's losing out.
Well, joining us from the ground in Kandahar, special advisor to General Stanley McChrystal, the top U.S. commander in Afghanistan, once again is Sarah Chase, who joins us via cell phone from Kandahar. We spoke with a BBC correspondent in Mazar-i-Sharif earlier who said that polling was very orderly and peaceful and that the likelihood in other parts of the country was that it would not be, and that would really skew the election results. What are you seeing at this point, Sarah?
In Kandahar City, voting is going, is taking place in a fairly orderly fashion. We've been getting voter rounds pretty regularly since about 2 in the morning, and one just hit, and then I heard some machine gun fire afterwards. So that has a real dampening effect on people's psychology. I was speaking to a soldier from Northern Ireland, actually, last night when I arrived, and he said, you know, when there was a bomb warning, he was from outside Belfast, when there was a bomb warning, you'd just not go down to town for beers on a Friday night. It's a similar psychology here. People aren't really willing to risk their lives in order to vote. So what you have here is, especially in the districts, not so much in Kandahar City, but in the districts that really are under effective Taliban control, people just are not voting. But the skew in the system is not that therefore there will be less Pashtun vote recorded. It's that then opens the door to manipulation of the results by primarily in this area the Karzai campaign, which is already doing some deals with election officials. In other words, you have the police, which are loyal to Karzai in one district that I've been following, basically making deals with election officials to allow them to set the ballot boxes.
Well, Sarah Chase, I just want to alert our listeners that it is difficult to hear you on a cell phone line, but you are in Kandahar, right, in really the center of the action there. So what's the most important advice to Stanley McChrystal, the person that you are advising? Is it the turnout, or is it the victor, the person who actually gets the most votes today?
I think the turnout issue is very important. I think it's important for international officials to compare any data that they may have that can give them a clear, you know, a fix on how many people actually voted, particularly in the dangerous districts, and compare that to the results that that are recorded for those districts. Now, that's not ISAF's job. ISAF is here to prevent physical danger to people on the day of the result, on the day of the vote. We're not, you know, it's not our responsibility to investigate the electoral procedures. However, it may be that ISAF can offer some data as to how many people were seen in the vicinity of polling places that could be very useful to the Election Complaints Commission.
Charlie Sennett, this is Amy Holmes here. Yesterday we talked to General Zinni about Afghanistan and our interest there, and it was notable that he did not discuss this election or democracy building or transparency. How important are these elections to U.S. interests moving forward?
I think they're very significant because you have to ask, 7 years into this experience of the United States being on the ground as an occupier and a military force in Afghanistan, what has been achieved? And if they are not able to provide security for this election, you know, it's a very fair question. What's been achieved? Where is it going to head? And I think the greatest challenge that the U.S. military faces in Afghanistan is countering the Taliban's hold in the south and the east in this very rural, very remote, rugged terrain. And one takeaway for listeners, I would say, is to remember that 3/4 of Afghanistan's population lives in the 30,000 villages that are outside the capital, that are these tiny hamlets that are impossible to get to. And this election is really about the challenge to bring order and security to those areas. Right now, time favors the Taliban, and
time
many
and
Afghans
space.
Are calculating
space. I mean, territory favors the Taliban as well.
Exactly. And time favors the Taliban in the sense that people are making the calculation that they believe the Taliban is going to be around longer than the U.S. forces on the ground.
Which raises another question to me. You use the word countering the Taliban. What about co-opting the Taliban? Mm-hmm. We saw reports that our troops are going to try to work with moderate Taliban. We saw in Iraq that part of the strategy there was to bring people into the system. Is that happening? Can that happen?
That's an excellent question. And I think the answer is yes, it is happening. It can happen. In our report on globalpost.com, we spoke with 6 Taliban leaders from the now deposed government about these ongoing negotiations. And we really tried to unpack the history and the complexity of Afghanistan in a way that you can see just how often it is that sides are switched in Afghanistan. This is sort of a part of the politics of Afghanistan is the shifting of allegiances. There are many moderate elements, as President Obama has called them, within the Taliban with whom the United States can negotiate. The hard part, as General Petraeus consistently points out, is deciphering who are the reconcilables. And right now, the U.S. military is in that process of trying to figure out exactly who they can negotiate with.
Well, it's also the hard part is actually saying that we're going to deal with the Taliban, which no U.S. official has been able to actually say. We just have about a minute, to Sarah Chase. I want to go back to you before we go. The president famously said in a meeting with veterans about a week and a half ago that the Afghan war is a war of necessity, that the U.S. has to be there because we were attacked. I don't believe it was the Taliban who attacked the United States. Do the people in Afghanistan believe this is a U.S. war of necessity?
They do believe that the United States takes it more seriously than any of its NATO allies. But I would just like to add to what Charlie just said about beginning to talk to the Taliban, to impress on listeners that the Afghan population is really caught in the middle. We, in order to fight the Taliban, the United States in particular, allied with real criminal leadership, brought it back into the country and established it in positions of power. That's largely why the Taliban insurgency has taken hold here. Nobody, I was in Kandahar at the fall of the Taliban government, and nobody was supporting it, and everyone was quite enthusiastic about the Karzai government. They've been disappointed by the Karzai government, but the international community has never really blown the whistle on some of the incredible instances of abuse of power and corruption, which the Afghan population thought it was up to the international community to do something about, since we had brought these people back into the country. So while it would be useful to work on a grassroots level to make it possible for Taliban foot soldiers to come back across, until there's a political system that people can, a political environment that people can bear to live under, that's not going to be a lot.
Right. Well, they're not on the ballot, but this referendum is very much about the Taliban. That's the takeaway from Sarah Chase, special advisor to General Stanley McChrystal. And Charles Sennett, where can we find globalpost.com?
Globalpost.com is online in our special report.
All right, great. Thanks,
Life,
Charlie.
Death and the Taliban.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Amy Holmes, and that's about as recognizable a sound as there is.
I was going to say, I remember that every Sunday.
But to say that someone invented news, if you're a broadcaster, that's generally kind of an insult. It's sort of a career-ending insult for some. But if you're talking about Don Hewitt, it's actually true. He died yesterday at the age of 86, the CBS legend, years before he created 60 Minutes, you just heard there. It can accurately be said he invented television news itself. Listen to him here tell the story of how, as a young reporter working for the Acme News Film Company, he went over to the CBS studios at Grand Central Terminal in Manhattan in 1947 and got a flash of insight as to what he wanted to do in life that would change the world.
Now, you got to realize, I was a kid who other kids went to the movies, and they either wanted to be Tom Mix, the cowboy, or they wanted to be Tarzan. I wanted to be either Hildy Johns on the front page or a guy named Julian Marsh, who was the producer in a musical called 42nd Street. And I never knew which one I wanted to be. And I walked into the CBS studio, and there were lights and cameras and stagehands and makeup artists and booms. And I looked around and I said, oh, my God, I can be both of them. In television, you can be the reporter and the producer. So I went back to Acme News Pictures, where I was working, and I said, I'm leaving. And they said, for what? And I said, television. And my boss said, that's a fad. That won't last. Well, I always figured he was half right. It is a fad, but it lasted. It's the longest lasting fad in history.
And Don Hewitt began it all, remembered this morning by our next guest, Jock Steinberg, New York Times reporter who for years covered the television beat, and Jeff Gralnick, longtime television journalist, former colleague of mine, friend and former colleague of Don Hewitt at CBS. Jeff, Don Hewitt could tell a story, and telling a story was what his entire career was all about, right?
Yeah, John, it was, and good morning. Everybody looks at television now and takes it for granted. In 1959, or when Don started, when I started, or in 1948 when Don started, I mean, television was just a great experiment, and you made it up as you went along. And Don set about making it up. He just invented the form as he went. Each day was different. Each day was exciting. Each day he tried to figure out how to do something different. First on Douglas Edwards with the news, which was 15 minutes long, and then on the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite, which was 30 minutes long.
Which he created. I mean, a former colleague of Don's, Ben Blank, used to tell me the story. He was also at ABC for a while, about how he and Hewitt would actually figure out the graphics for the news. They'd go down to a hardware store, and they were doing some sort of space story, and they bought a globe, and they created a little diorama set and shot it with the globe going around in a little fake sort of rocket ship. I mean, they were doing it by the skin of their teeth.
Yeah, and the beauty of those stories is they're all true. I mean, Ben Blank was another one of the early geniuses. But what was so good about those days is there were no rules. You tried it. If it didn't work, you went and tried something else. And Don was never satisfied with what was on television. And one day the stock market had a record day, 5 million shares. 5 million shares were traded on one day. And
wow.
Don tried to figure out how to put a big enough arrow on the screen to demonstrate what had happened. One day the weather was really bad in Chicago, and we switched. We did live from Chicago into Douglas Edwards with the news. I mean, that was magic in 1959.
I mean, Don Hewitt figured out how to do pictures and narration at the same time. People don't even remember that back in the early days that wasn't possible. Jacques Steinberg, New York Times reporter who covered television. How did Don Hewitt create the news and create the rules of television news and also break them?
I mean, it's amazing. You guys both worked in the business. For those of us who are outsiders, viewers, he was largely unknown to us, but we see his influence every day, several times a day, in so many shows beyond 60 Minutes. I loved one story he told me was how he created. Do you guys call it the lower third, the text that goes on the screen, mm-hmm. at the bottom of the screen, that he had been at a restaurant in Chicago during the Democratic National Convention in 1952, and the waitress came over and said, at a diner, what will you have? And he said, I'll have the whole menu. And she said, you can't have everything on the menu. He said, no, I want the menu. It was a sort of a pegboard menu on the wall that he imagined he could use to use text at the bottom of the screen. And he got it, too. And that gave birth to what we now see.
That's so interesting to me, too.
Talk about 60 Minutes and this idea of sort of mini documentaries in prime time. A show that might have a hard-hitting interview followed by a profile of an entertainer, something we totally take for granted on so many shows, and yet Don created it.
I was going to say that as a younger person and a consumer of the news, that when I look at 60 Minutes, I see what so many journalists aspire to, whereas he might have tried to break the standard. He also created the gold standard of investigative journalism, long-form pieces where you really have a chance to, you know, dig in there.
And it hadn't been done before. 2020, primetime live, Dateline, and then unfortunately, Access Hollywood, Entertainment Tonight, you know, sort of taking unfortunately parts of what Don hoped for. The beauty of Don was that you could get it all on 60
right.
Minutes. Sometimes it doesn't work when you just break off a piece of it.
Well, Jeff Gralnick, leave us with this, won't you? He thought he might go into the movies, Don Hewitt did, but he eventually made it into the movies in The Insider. Which was the story about the whole tobacco industry controversy at 60 Minutes. Did Don Hewitt love the fact that he actually made it into the movies, Jeff?
I hope you don't mind me jumping on that question because he hated it, and he hated that movie, and he spoke about it at Columbia J School. He was very angry at Lowell Bergman, the producer who that story was based on.
All right, quick comment from Jeff Gralnick. Go ahead.
Yeah, Don loved everything he did. There wasn't a day he woke up that he didn't know it was going to be exciting, and there wasn't a day that ended with Don where he didn't know there was something else he could have done. He just hadn't figured it out yet. And I don't know who replaces the Don Hewitts. I don't know who replaces the Rune Orliges. I know that we're going through an era of the passing of the guard, and we're all poorer for it.
Well, I can tell you no one replaces Don Hewitt. Jeff Gralnick, longtime television journalist, friend, and former colleague of Don Hewitt at CBS. Jacques Steinberg, New York Times reporter who covered the television beat for the New York Times. Thanks to both of you remembering Don Hewitt, who died yesterday at the age of 86.
And a quick look at the headlines, John?
Yes, just a moment ago, Scotland's justice minister is freeing the man convicted in the 1988 Lockerbie bombings. He has terminal cancer. We talked about it on this program last week. It's definitely a controversial decision. And Harvard and Princeton share the top spot in the U.S. News and World Report annual college rankings. Those are some of the top stories we're following this morning.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning. John Hockenberry here with Amy Holmes. We're talking about the violence amidst an attempt in Afghanistan to go to the polls. We're also talking about violence affecting civil authority in Iraq. The death toll is rising in Iraq. Two more people killed in an explosion this morning. The total dead, 100 in the past 2 days, the deadliest bout of violence there since the U.S. halted street patrols in June, with many government buildings damaged from the bombing yesterday. Scope and sophistication of these attacks on the Capitol come at a pivotal political time for Iraq's president, Nouri al-Maliki. He's very much on the defensive this morning. Joining us is Sam Dagger, the New York Times correspondent in Baghdad. Also, Noah Feldman, Harvard University law professor and a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He joins us from Westport Island, Maine. First, Sam, very much a defensive Iraqi government this morning, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we already have reports of at least 10 security officials detained pending an investigation. Lots of questions this morning about, you know, how these attacks happened, how the trucks were able to penetrate what is probably one of the most sensitive and secure areas of the capital.
It seems like there are two really big issues this morning. The first is the legitimacy of the Iraqi government. Can it protect its own citizens? And the second is an issue raised by one of your colleagues, Rod Nordland, that will this ignite greater sectarian violence going forward? Sam, what do you think?
Well, again, I mean, it's certainly too early yet, but obviously the fallout from what happened yesterday is tremendous. I mean, already some hardline Shiite political parties are calling on the prime minister to sack security officials who were responsible for this area. I mean, this area is under the control of the Baghdad Operations Command. And also these same Shiite officials are also, lashing out at, recent reconciliation efforts, recent amnesties that were extended by the government to insurgents and saying, people who are suspected of being behind these attacks should be hanged. I mean, those were the words of Hadi Al-Amiri, a senior politician.
There's a crater in more than just the ground in front of the foreign ministry there in Baghdad. Noah Feldman, Harvard University law professor, one bombing shut down the United Nations operation back in 2003 in Iraq. Do you think this single bombing is likely to have those kinds of far-reaching consequences?
Not yet. And the reason is simply that the number of bombings that have occurred in the interim, tragically, has been such that Iraqis have actually become, you can't be acclimated, but they're accustomed to these kinds of terrible attacks. And so although this attack is clearly intended as a challenge to the legitimacy of the Iraqi government and has obviously, even in the first day or so, had real effects on the politics of Iraq, it would take more such attacks in order to substantially undercut the functioning of the government. It's not that this one attack is going to lead the Iraqi government to run away. Remember that the United Nations, after the United Nations bombed, the United Nations left because the head of their mission, Sergio Vieira de Mello, had been killed, and they hadn't been well, the mission had not been well secured, and they had somewhere to go, whereas the Iraqi government has nowhere to go.
But Noah, this is Amy Holmes here. This is an attack in Baghdad. Does that have special significance? We expect violence in Mosul and other places. Baghdad, we had hoped, had become relatively secure.
Yes, Baghdad is the symbolic center of the country, and this attack in particular was aimed at government ministries, the foreign ministry and finance ministry, designed to attack what are clearly perceived as the symbols of the government. So this is, first of all, an attack on civilians aimed at trying in some way to reinstate the civil war that had significantly died down over the last several years. But it's also directly an attempt to say that the government of Iraq is not, in fact, in control of the streets in Iraq. And it's very significant that it's in Baghdad.
So it's designed to say that. Do you think it could actually accomplish that?
Again, a single attack probably can't do that. But if it were the first of a sustained series of attacks, then the criticism of the Maliki government that's already beginning now would deepen. And it would, more importantly, show that the reality is that any government that can't protect its citizens will eventually lose legitimacy. And if this is the first in a series, or rather not the first, but one of a series of attacks that has that effect, that will definitely harm the government.
Which certainly is a rationale for the government being so strident and strong in its response, at least rhetorically. Sam Dagher, what is the likelihood that some character will emerge here as a sort of opposition figure to the government as we learn more about what was behind this bombing?
Sure. I would just go back to what I described earlier. Positions are hardening. I mean, this comes at a very, very delicate time for Maliki. There is a tremendous pressure on him by his current Shiite allies to join, their coalition, which is largely a reconstituted version of the Shiite-led coalition that ran in 2005, and there's a tremendous pressure from Iran on Maliki to join this coalition. In fact, the ambassador, told me bluntly earlier this month, we expect this. These are people that we nurtured, and this is a return on our investment, and we want these people to have good relations with us. And on the other hand, there is also tremendous pressure on Maliki to from the U.S. side to broaden his coalition in the next elections, which are in January, and to include lots of Sunnis and even people who were insurgents and have said that they've renounced violence and want to join the political process. I think this attack, the two attacks yesterday in Baghdad, I think have already undermined Maliki because, A, the people who are responsible for security in Baghdad are this entity called the Baghdad Operations Command, which is directly under his control. And these people report to him directly.
Which is why he's being held accountable, at least at this moment. Nouri al-Maliki very much on a tightrope this morning. Also, the sense of what to change about the rules of engagement of U.S. forces in Iraq, another thing to watch. Good takeaways this morning from Sam Dagher, a New York Times correspondent in Baghdad. Also, Noah Feldman, a Harvard University law professor and a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Thanks to you both. Now, a look at some headlines we're also following this morning. Amy?
Just in this hour, Scotland's justice minister is freeing the man convicted in the 1988 Lockerbie aircraft bombing. The release is on humanitarian grounds. He has terminal cancer. It comes despite American objections. 270 died in the explosion, including many Americans. Also new this hour, we've got new numbers on employment. 576,000 Americans filed new unemployment claims last week. That's higher than forecasters expected.
About 15,000 higher. Markets are reacting negatively to that. Voting is winding down in Afghanistan's presidential elections. Election officials extended voting by 1 hour. And reports from the ground say turnout was lower than expected. Militant attacks shut down several polling stations in certain regions around the country.
The U.S. deficit for this year will be more than $260 billion lower than expected. It'll still be the largest ever, though, at nearly $1.6 trillion. The new lower figure is in part because the Obama administration spent less than expected on bank bailouts.
No, they didn't save $260 billion anywhere. Don't take that away from this. Ailing Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy wants the state to replace him quickly. If needed, he wants state leaders to change the succession law so that if his seat becomes empty, the governor can appoint an immediate successor. Aides say there's been no material change in the senator's brain cancer condition. North Korean, or those are some of the top stories that we are following this morning. Amy?
Good morning. You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Amy Holmes.
And I'm John Huckenberry. And we welcome back to the program Susan Cohen, who's the mother of a Pan Am Flight 103 victim, Theodora Cohen, who died at age 20. She's the co-author with her husband, Daniel, of the book Pan Am 103, The Bombing, The Betrayals, and A Bereaved Family's Search for Justice. Susan, the reason we're speaking to you this morning is that as we spoke about a week and a half ago, it appears that the Scottish Justice Minister has freed one of the Lockerbie bombers on compassionate grounds because of his terminal illness, and that's despite protests from you and protests from the U.S. government. First of all, your reaction?
Well, it's absolutely appalling to talk about, compassionate release for a mass murderer like this. I mean, he's a convicted mass murderer, a terrorist who dropped his appeal. It's so sickening, but look at it. They are rushing him out of there today so fast. Why? Why? What are they afraid of? I will tell you what this is about. This is about Shell Oil and British Petroleum and the oil interests who have really, really wanted a complete rapprochement with Gaddafi. They're making a great deal of money. They are appeasing Gaddafi. The governments are following suit, the British government with Tony Blair. Absolutely horrible. Our government, well, Bush went on television and didn't even, when he made friends with Gaddafi and didn't even mention Pan Am 103, talked about differences with the Libyan leader. I think they were looking for any excuse to do this because it takes away the last remnant that there even ever was a Lockerbie bombing. Now no one is in prison. The families have lost the tiny shred of justice we had. The chances of ever learning more should really go up to Gaddafi because it's impossible for something like this to happen.
Mrs. Cohen?
In Libya without his involvement.
Mrs. Yes. Cohen, this is Amy Holmes here. I just wanted to know, are you in touch with other families who are sharing the same point of view?
Absolutely. Every American family I know is very, very upset about this. There are a few British families who claim that he's innocent, Megrahi, but that is irrelevant to this issue. And may I point out that Gaddafi had a massive, massive public relations campaign all across Europe and Britain that he couldn't do here. And whether you think he's innocent or guilty is irrelevant. He was convicted. This upturns all the work of the Scottish legal system. It upturns our work. It's just
well,
one
Susan,
of those.
Susan, because you are a family, you know, a member of one of the victims of 103, Abdul Basit Ali Al-Megrahi, who is the person who is released today. I mean, the argument makes total sense coming from you. But why doesn't it make sense to the British government or to the Americans?
Because the British government has made a deal. I don't mean a conspiratorial deal. Because they caved to the oil interests. They caved to the oil interests. Gaddafi has long said he wants Megrahi back.
Do you believe, though, let's just focus on that. Do you believe that Gaddafi has made Megrahi's release conditional on access to the oil?
From everything I've been hearing, I'm not surprised at this. I've known this has been coming for a long time.
Well, Susan, you
mentioned everything that he wants. Ask me what Gaddafi has wanted that he hasn't gotten.
Well, Susan, you mentioned the last time we talked to you that it would be very painful to see a hero's welcome in Tripoli for Megrahi welcomed back to Libya. Susan Cohen is the mother of Pan Am Flight 103 victim Theodora Cohen, reacting to the release of a Lockerbie bomber today on humanitarian grounds. Thank you, Susan.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. Coming up, we're going to be talking to some early birds who are hoping to gobble up all the worms. They're starting their new businesses, even in a time of recession. We want to know from you. Are you taking risks? Are you going out there and starting something new? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. But first, a look at the headlines. John?
Just in this hour, Scotland's justice minister is freeing the man convicted in the 1988 Lockerbie aircraft bombing. He has terminal cancer. The release is on humanitarian grounds. It comes despite U.S. objections to the release. 270 died in the explosion, including many Americans. In Afghanistan, election officials extended presidential election voting by 1 hour today. Militant attacks shut down several polling sites, but this voter says it's his duty to turn out.
For the country's sake, you had to vote. And I know there is a lot of concerns all over the country. But this morning I thought I have to go, no matter what happens.
Election officials say voter turnout was low in parts of the country. This just in from the White House. The White House says it deeply regrets that Scottish decision we reported a moment ago to release the convicted Lockerbie bomber. Amy?
Back in the U.S., the White House also says it's set to reduce its estimate for this year's deficit to a mere $1.6 trillion. They've been handing out less bailout cash than they expected, which is why the deficit is down a couple hundred billion dollars than what they first anticipated.
Iraq's Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki is blaming Sunni insurgents for the series of deadly bombings that killed more than 100 yesterday. Another Baghdad bombing killed two more today. And those are some of the top stories that we're following this morning.
So it's Thursday, and that means we're going to be talking about work. So in the middle of a recession, what does it take to start a small business? Do you have to be crazy, crazy like a fox? In a few minutes, we'll talk to some people who've actually been in the trenches and started small businesses against all odds. And I also want to ask listeners, where's the opportunity in a recession? Do you see it? What business risks have you taken despite the odds?
Revlon began in 1932 at the peak of the Depression.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, you just have to be such a risk taker.
Everyone's out of work. Let's have makeup. Let's get some lipstick.
Let me take my savings and sink it into something new.
Brilliant move. It was a brilliant move.
So please give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Now we're joined by Takeaway contributor Beth Kobliner. Beth is the author of Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s. And frankly, I could use it in your 40s and 50s. Beth, do you have to be crazy? Do you have to be nuts to start a business right now in this kind of economy?
You know, I found myself wondering about this. This sort of origin of the story was I was walking around in Maine and I met this woman who started a business who we're going to be talking to later. And I thought, is she optimistic, nuts, or both? You know, they're not mutually exclusive. But in this economy, it is so difficult to imagine why people are doing this. And yet, everybody's been saying it kind of gives them that karmic kick in the butt that they need to get started. Look, the economy's bad. I don't have a job. I'm about to lose my job. And maybe I'll give it a shot.
Well, could there actually be some advantages to starting a new business now? I mean, that kind of the early bird gets the worm theory?
Absolutely. You know, I think that the main thing is people who tend to start businesses during this tough time are more cost conscious, you know, than people who started during boom times. Rents are cheaper now and people are penny pinching up front, of course, and having to think outside of the box. And also what they see is bigger, more established competitors, you know, may be having to cut back and lay off people or maybe not having that great service they used to have. So a new company could start, a small business could start and really have that edge.
Well, let's bring in our lady entrepreneurs who have lived on that edge and started successful new businesses. Joining us are Marva Allen, co-owner of Human Bookstore, successful entrepreneur. She's here in the studio in New York. And Jo Ellen Stahman of Camden, Maine. She's a new small business owner of Accents for Your Home. Ladies, thank you. Welcome. Good morning. So, Marva, let's start with you. You started your first business at 23, so basically you've always been crazy.
Always been crazy. And crazy don't scare me.
Right. But crazy like a fox, you managed to turn it into a multi-million dollar business. Tell us how you did it.
Well, you know, back in 1981 when we started, it was a boom of technology. We've been through that boom, seeing the bust and back again. And we were two young women, my sister and I, on the cusp of that journey. And we were able to take that idea and turn it into a very good business. And as you say, a downturn in economy makes entrepreneurs extremely creative. So they figure it out.
So, Jo Ellen, you are figuring it out up there in Camden, Maine. Are you optimistic? Are you crazy? How do you explain it?
I am both. Mm-hmm. I am very optimistic, and I think that really is profiting us. I hear from other business owners, they have a history. We don't have history, and so our only way up for us is up. And I think people feed off that energy. They're coming in the door. They're seeing two women, my daughter and I, very creative women, lots of color, lots of light, and they're in a dark place. A lot of them are just kind of, you know, hearing the news and everything, and they're looking for something positive. And so when they come in, I tell you, it's just like smiles on their faces. They go, oh, like this, and it lifts them. And we have a wide range of prices so that anybody can take a little piece back with them and make their house just a little bit brighter. That makes people happy in all different levels.
So you started your business in the fall when the banks were failing. I mean, that was what was on the front pages of all the newspapers and, you know, bailouts, AIG. How did you take that first step?
Well, we were very tight. We do everything in-house. We're all artists, and so we can do all our publicity, all our books, our catalogs, our website by ourselves. That helps a lot. And
those are her kids, by the way. Her employees are her kids.
Yes, and that helps too, you know. And, you know, of course, I didn't take an income for myself to start, just, you know, dealing with some loans and just paying my two children. So there were things, you know, working for us that
Marvia,
way.
Marvia, I saw you nodding your head. When you started that first business at 23, how did you jump in? Did you have savings? Did you have money saved up?
No, not at all. I was a fresh graduate out of the University of Michigan. I was on my way to medical school, and my brother-in-law, who is sort of a frustrated businessman, said, you know, this technology business is the way of the future. I had recently been divorced with a young child, and I thought there was no way I was going to do 4 years of medical school, 3 years of residency. I was going to take a chance on me. And so I figured,
I love that. Take a chance on me. That's fantastic.
I felt pretty confident that if I was committed to the win, that I could do it. And with a young child, you almost have to do it. So that was a big motivation for me, and we did.
Beth Kobliner, you're hearing these really inspirational stories. For our listeners who may not want to have to go into the office to that cubicle and have that boss hovering over them and start a new business, what's the first step?
Well, I think to just splash a little bit of pessimism on this, you know, before the recession kicked in, we saw more small new businesses starting every month than failing. In other words, every month we'd see a net gain of 15,000 new businesses start. And we're talking about really small companies under four people. Now it's flipped, and we're seeing more failing per month than starting. So that bit of reality makes it much more challenging for people. All that being said, I think there are some great opportunities, but it's very important not to, for example, dip into your 401k, or if you have IRA savings, long-term retirement savings that you built up, don't use that to start a new business, but you can use your severance money. And the other thing I would say is just be really careful with credit cards, because as we all know, credit card companies, you know, a few years ago, there'd be all these stories about people starting. Absolutely. And also they're freezing credit lines. So people get a credit line, a business credit card, they think they have this line of credit, and then it gets frozen and they're stuck. So there are some ways to do this, but you have to be careful.
So, John, it sounds like to me that the takeaway is you have to use your head and your heart.
Well, Beth Koblenner knows how you can get stuck. She has the best advice in the biz.
That was Beth Koblenner, takeaway contributor and author of Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s. We also were talking to Marva Allen, co-owner of Human Bookstore, and she's a successful entrepreneur here in the studio with us in New York, and also Jo Ellen Stahman of Camden, Maine, who recently started her own business in home decor. Thank you all.
And they're not the only ones. I mean, who's taking a risk in this recession? Harold writes to us, I started my own manufacturing consulting firm back in 1990 at the height of the last recession. I lost my job, decided to hang out my own shingle instead of looking for another one, and decided to do advertising on our program as well. Many of my friends wondered why I'd give up the security of a full-time employment. Well, 19 years later, I have my own successful business. Almost all of my friends with, quote, secure jobs have had their own rough times. Start a business in a recession. If the time is right for you, take the plunge. Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. On the other side of the world, here's your takeaway.
The central government, Karzai's government, cracked down on the media and has been preventing them from reporting on the violence that led up to it. So there's another sort of subplot to this election, which is the free press. And that's not winning in this election. That's losing out.
Longtime journalist Charles Sennett talking about the Afghan elections, which the polls just closed a little while ago. If you missed anything on The Takeaway, take our podcast to go.
I'm Amy Holmes.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Strike me down in anger. Here I stand. I'm your man.
In the last two election cycles, voters struck Republicans down in anger, but Republicans are back with an issue they hope will make them your man.
I've been running through all of these promises to you that I made, and I could not keep.
We're going to ask them about those promises here on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, listeners. It's Thursday, August 20th. I'm Amy Holmes, and I'm here with John Hockenberry, who's back.
Good morning, Amy. Glad to be back. Coming up this hour, we'll have the latest from the elections in Afghanistan, plus how to avoid being an online sucker when it comes to real estate. Also, an update on a convicted Lockerbie bomber who's been released today.
But first, we have Fred Barnes, executive editor of the Weekly Standard, here to talk about those Republicans. Fred, thanks so much for joining us.
Glad to be here.
So your colleague, Bill Kristol, he thinks that Republicans should just stand back and let Democrats commit political suicide. Do you agree with that strategy?
Well, they will commit political suicide if they stick with a top-to-bottom plan that would overhaul the entire health care system. But now Democrats have gotten a little wiser, and they're talking about splitting up the bill into individual parts. It's a new strategy, and it might attract some Republicans.
But can Republicans afford to be the party of no?
They can be the afford to be the party of no to a huge comprehensive plan because it's already been rejected by the voters. The polls show that overwhelmingly.
Well, Fred, please stay with us. We're going to continue that conversation in a moment. But first, everything you need to know this morning. John?
Well, in the headlines, Amy, Scotland's justice minister is freeing the man convicted in the 1988 Lockerbie plane bombing because he has terminal cancer. The White House says it, quote, deeply regrets, unquote, the release. 270 people died in that bombing, including many Americans. More on this later in the hour. In Afghanistan, election officials extended presidential election voting by 1 hour today. Militant attacks shut down several polling sites, though. Election officials say voter turnout was low in many parts of the country.
Back in the U.S., fresh numbers on the job market are just out. The number of people filing for jobless benefits was up again last week. 576,000 Americans filed new unemployment claims. That's higher than forecasters expected.
And in the Atlantic, Hurricane Bill has weakened slightly to a Category 3 storm. Forecasters say it could gain strength again today or tomorrow. Overseas, Iraq's prime minister is blaming Sunni insurgents for that series of deadly bombings that killed more than 100 yesterday. There was another Baghdad bombing that killed two more today. Markets were up slightly yesterday. The Dow opens at 92.79. The S&P starts trading at 9.96. And the NASDAQ begins at 19.69. And the markets turned right around in the futures trading as soon as those employment numbers that Amy mentioned came out early this morning. So we are in the middle of a recession. You know that. Is opening a business right now a good bet? Some of you have actually been weighing in, saying that there's opportunities in the recession. There are a lot of big businesses that started during the Depression. Revlon, General Electric started during the financial panic of 1873. Hewlett-Packard actually began back in the 30s in the middle of the Depression. What's the opportunity in a recession? Tell us the story that of the risks that you are taking, and you can do that by calling us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Call us, you entrepreneurs.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning. This is Amy Holmes here with John Hockenberry. So, John, healthcare. The White House seems to be all over the map. This weekend, they said it was...
Well, there's the Democrat map. I mean, they're trying to resolve bipartisanship within the Democratic Party.
Right.
Are we for a public plan, a public option? Are we not for a public option? I don't know.
And then do we reach across the aisle? And then that seems to be all under consideration.
But what Rahm Emanuel said, we don't need the Republicans or something like that.
Robert Gibbs said something completely different.
The president believes strongly in working with Republicans and Democrats, independents, any that seek to reform health care. They want to see costs cut, coverage increased, insurance reforms implemented.
Wanted someone to collaborate with the Obama administration on health care. Inquire at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. That's what that sounds like to me.
So are you emphasizing past tense, wanted to work with the Republicans?
We'll work with anyone.
Well,
someone work with us.
We actually have some Republicans on the line, and we're going to ask them, do Republicans want to work with Democrats? We've been talking so much about President Obama and his strategy within his own party. What about the other side of the aisle and how they're approaching health care? We have with us Fred Barnes, the executive editor of the Weekly Standard, and Ryman Salam, the author of Grand New Party, How Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream. Fred, I want to start with you. You know, we saw all these town hall meetings and Democratic Congress people being, you know, under fire. But what about Republicans? Can they really afford just to sit back and watch?
Sure. Look, they're not really players here. They're not players at all in the House. There's some Republican senators who are negotiating in the Senate, but Democrats won't get them at all. And I mean, Democrats first need, and Obama needs to step forward and say, look, we have abandoned the idea of a public health insurance plan. And then there's a chance.
Why does he need to do that? Why does he need to do that?
Because a lot of Democrats don't like it either. It can't pass in the first place, and it would assuage some Republicans. Start there, and there might be some opportunities for compromise. Look, the only reason why Democrats will want Republicans in the first place is to get cover for their moderates who won't vote for Obama's comprehensive plan unless there's some Republicans along with it.
So, Fred, that would suggest to me then that Republicans shouldn't give them that. What do you say?
No, of course not. They shouldn't give in on the public option and a lot of other things as well. And Democrats aren't going to be able to push through a plan with such large popular opposition to it. Now, as every poll reflects, it's one thing to criticize the histrionics at these town hall meetings. The important thing is that the opposition we see there is reflected in national polls. And Obama and the Democrats are just in terrible trouble on health care, and they can't decide what to do, as we just reflected as the different approaches at the White House itself between Rahm Emanuel and Robert Gibbs.
So, Raihan Salam, I want to bring you into this because while it's true we see the polling data that approval for Democrats and the president are going down, we're not seeing approval for Republicans go up. So what do you say to that?
I think that some of the opposition we're seeing in the country is opposition to big government, and that's broadly in tune with Republican and conservative goals. But I think that some of the opposition is just fear of any kind of change at all. And I think that it's important for Republicans to recognize a distinction between those two things, to try to cultivate the one, but to recognize that the other is going to be a long-term political problem, not only for the president, but also for them.
Which means, Fred, that this isn't necessarily an opportunity for Republicans, because people have all kinds of fear of change. That doesn't mean that there's some sort of huge national mandate to throw out the public option. Quite the contrary.
I think there is.
No, there's just a lot of fear of change, as your colleague was saying, Rehan.
Look, well, we know one thing because every poll shows it, and that's that people are very comfortable. A huge majority, over 80%, are comfortable with their health insurance and their health care now. To convince them that they should reform that drastically, as the Obama administration wants, is a very tough sell, and they haven't been able to sell it, and the public plans are part of it.
But Raihan Salam, author of Grand New Party, How Republicans Can Win the Working Class, Republicans have not done well in past elections. We see in polling data that while more people consider themselves conservative than Republican, they're putting Democrats in power. So can Republicans really afford to sit on their hands and watch Democrats' approval numbers go down while they're not offering anything in, you know, as an alternative?
I agree with the broad thrust of what you're saying. I think that Republicans do need to emphasize their alternatives, and they have offered alternatives that I think are very promising. I agree with Fred on the public insurance option in particular. I think it's good news for the country that the White House is inching away from that idea. On the other hand, I think that if the bill is split into smaller pieces, what I want to see is Republicans backing some of the smaller pieces. For example, the idea of a national health insurance exchange, a marketplace that would help small employers and folks on the individual market.
Well, right.
Really does help them.
I saw that on National Review's website that you endorsed the co-op plan, but you know what? A lot of conservatives and Republicans are saying that this is government run by another name.
Well, look, I didn't actually endorse the plan. What I said is we can't be reflexively opposed to it. We don't know what a co-op plan would look like. If a co-op plan is trying to move the country away from fee-for-service medicine towards something that actually makes more sense, is more productive and efficient over the long term, that isn't necessarily a bad thing. We still don't know what the proposal is going to be. So I think we just need to be a bit more open about some of those ideas.
So, Fred, I want to bring you back into this and look at some recent history. You know, I used to work for Senator Frist when he was majority leader, and he campaigned against Tom Daschle for being an inside-the-beltway obstructionist, out of touch with his own constituents. And you know what? Tom Daschle lost, you know, his position. Is this something that Democrats can turn back on Republicans if they are obstructionists?
Not on this issue. Look, we went through this in 1993 and 1994, and the same arguments were used. Poor Republicans, they're against health care reform, and they're the bill that was drafted by First Lady then Hillary Clinton. We went through that whole thing, and what was the result of it? The result was, in 1994, one of the greatest Republican victories of the century.
Right, Fred, and, but who led that, though? Who led that? Newt Gingrich and Phil Graham of Texas, and where are they today?
Well, they're not in Congress now, but that doesn't...
Because they were run out of Congress for being obstructionists.
And then they held Congress for 12 years. Look, Phil Graham's not out of Congress because he was an obstructionist, nor is that the reason Bill Frist is out. The truth is that the public has rejected... And I think has rejected firmly what Obama has offered. Now, it's up to him to make a new approach. You can break the bill into different parts. You can say we're not going to have a public plan. And the truth is, he's not going to get enough Democratic votes if he doesn't do that. And he needs to do it quickly.
And, Fred, that might be true, but we're also seeing from Pew polling data that the public is blaming Republicans more than Democrats for the fact that people aren't, you know, getting along and working it out. Whether you agree with that or not, that seems to be the way the public is viewing it.
Yeah, but look at the public polls that are more important than that. What does it show? It shows Obama sinking. He spent 10 days going after on the health care issue in July, and in the Gallup poll, he went down 9 points. And you break up the parts of the Obama plan, and all those parts are being rejected. It's not just the town hall meetings. It's the public at large. Obama's losing this argument.
It seems to me that the most important poll, though, is that the Democrats control the White House and both houses of Congress, and they were elected on a plan to do something about health care. Would you support a public cooperative plan, any sort of co-op, nonprofit option?
Well, not the way the Democrats are talked about it. And here's what worries Republicans, and that is that Senator Baucus, the head of the Finance Committee, Senator Schumer, even President Obama, himself has said they want a co-op plan. They'll go for a co-op plan as long as it's just like the public plan.
But when you say I will not support a co-op option the way the Democrats are talking about it, I mean, that's exactly the language of obstruction. If the Democrats say it, I'm opposed to it.
Look. Here's how politics works. The out party succeeds when the in party fails. The polls on the Republicans don't matter now. What matters is the polls on the Democrats. And they're in power. They have votes in Congress. They have the White House. And if they overreach or they fail or both, then Republicans will triumph in the next election, whether whatever their numbers are right now in approval rating by the public.
Rayhan
it's
Salaam.
The failure of the in party that leads to the out party winning.
Rayhan Salaam, I want to ask you, do you agree with that? Do you think the Republicans can just sit and watch Democrats overreach, or do they need to be proactive?
Two small things. One is that I think Fred is absolutely right. On Social Security, the Democrats united against President Bush's reform proposals, and that was a huge source of success for them. Similarly, the surge strategy was something that was completely owned by a Republican president. The Democrats, to the extent they could within the budgetary process, raised the possibility of trying to obstruct it, and they weren't able to. So I think that, again, President Bush owned that policy, and now it's not entirely crazy for the Democrats to want to own health reform. John earlier on mentioned Clinton's health reform effort in the 1990s. The thing is, Republicans might have actually profited had the Democrats owned that and passed that, and then had it been really problematic and had it been profoundly unpopular.
Well, we'll see how Republicans try to profit on the health care debate. I want to thank both of you for joining us. That was Fred Barnes, the executive editor of the Weekly Standard, and Rayhan Salaam, the author of Grand New Party, How Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry here with Amy Holmes. So an unsettling milestone, it's fair to say, nearly 21 years after the Lockerbie bombing, the Pan Am jet that was brought down by terrorists over Lockerbie, Scotland.
It is my decision that Mr. Abdel Basset Ali Mohamed Al-Megrahi, convicted in 2001 for the Lockerbie bombing, now terminally ill with prostate cancer, be released on compassionate grounds and are allowed to return to Libya to die.
That is Scottish Justice Secretary Kenny McCaskill announcing his ruling in Edinburgh today. He's freed the Lockerbie bomber on, as he said, compassionate grounds. December 21st, 1988, a bomb exploded aboard Pan Am Flight 103 as it flew over Lockerbie, Scotland. 270 people inside and outside that plane were killed. And Alan Cowell, senior correspondent for our partner, the New York Times, you covered that Lockerbie story. First of all, 21 years later, what does this milestone mean?
I think it means a lot of things to many of the people involved, but I don't think it's going to make anybody particularly happy, certainly not the American families who have been mourning their lost ones now for 21 years. I don't think it will make the British families particularly happy at events either, because it means that the chances of having the case reopened will be lost when Mr. Megrahi flies back to Libya. Although he has now dropped an appeal against his conviction, but he still maintains his innocence. He hasn't withdrawn that. And, of course, any further action, any further legal action that could have led to a reopening of the case in Scotland now seems very unlikely.
Alan Cowell, this is Amy Holmes here. Earlier in the show, we talked to Susan Cohen, a mother of a woman who was killed at age of 20 in this Pan Am flight, and she was very angry, very passionate about this decision.
Absolutely appalling to talk about, compassionate release for a mass murderer like this.
Alan, are you hearing similar reactions from British families?
The British families have been rather more silent, because they've always maintained that many of them, and the people who speak for them, they've never accepted the conviction. There's always been a belief in Britain that the evidence that was brought against Megrahi was always circumstantial, that they believe his protestations of innocence, and they want a broader inquiry to look into the conspiracy that lay behind this. They see Mr. Megrahi much more as a fool fall guy than as a perpetrator. So they would not experience the same grief as American families who seen his conviction and his sentencing and his staying in prison as the only form of justice that they've received since 1988.
Well, Alan Cowell, perhaps conspiracy is the apt term here, whether you're a British victim or an American victim. And again, I should mention you're a senior correspondent for the New York Times, covered the Lockerbie bombing as well as covering this particular story. The Scottish say that legally they have to release him if he is terminally ill. But there is a suspicion on the part of victims that there is some side deal being made here between the justice officials and the mystery man himself, Muammar Gaddafi, who victims say knows all about what happened in 1988.
Well, of course, if you go back to the 80s and look at what was going on then and the kind of things that Libya was accused of, that was when Libya was a pariah state, as Colonel Gaddafi supported any number of movements that would be regarded as terrorists these days. He, of course, has personally denied knowing anything about the detail of the Lockerbie case, but against that, he's paid $2.7 billion in compensation, if that's the right word, to the families of those who were lost on that day, on that night in December 1988. So, yes, there is plenty of room for speculation about a wider conspiracy.
Is there any legal option for reopening the case and getting some of those questions answered, or does the whole question of who and what was behind the Lockerbie bombing die with Megrahi?
I think that the way things stand at the moment, there's nothing in Scotland that's likely to happen. He's withdrawn his appeal against his sentence. That might have opened up some of the evidence that was not completely publicized from a Scottish judicial review in 2007 relating to this case and enabling him to make a second appeal. The only other appeal outstanding is by the Scottish authorities, who had complained that his sentence was not severe enough, and they have until early September to withdraw that appeal. It is not very clear what they plan to do, but there's certainly no means at the moment or no obvious channel for further legal action that would throw more light onto this case or indeed expose any other perpetrators other than Mr. Megrahi, who, of course, is the only convict. He has been tried by Scottish judges, and he has been sentenced, and he has been found guilty.
So, Alan, here's just a process question. Now that he's been released, will he be able to travel freely?
I think that's the plan, is so that he, even as we speak, he may be getting ready, if he's not already on his way, to Glasgow Airport. Mr. McCaskill, the Justice Minister, did say that within an hour of the news conference at which this decision was announced, Mr. McGrahi would be leaving Greenock Prison. He'd be on his way to Glasgow Airport. There have been reports that a plane is being sent by the Libyan authorities, by Colonel Gaddafi himself, to fly him home.
And Alan Cowell, senior correspondent for the New York Times, the takeaway there is, will there be a hero's welcome of any kind, a very public sort of welcoming home of Megrahi inside Libya? Many of the family victims have mentioned that that would be a painful picture for them to see indeed. Alan Cowell, thanks so much. Alan Cowell joining us this morning from Paris. Let's check in on some of the morning's other top stories.
Our partner, the New York Times, reports that the CIA hired private contractor Blackwater in 2004 for a secret program to capture and kill top al-Qaeda operatives. No terrorists were ever killed through the program. Current CIA Director Leon Panetta recently canceled it. Blackwater, now known as Z Services, has drawn frequent criticism for aggressive tactics in Iraq. Polls are now closed in Afghanistan's presidential election. Election officials had extended voting by an hour. Reports from the ground said turnout was lower than expected. Militant attacks shut down several polling stations early.
President Obama is all over health care again today. He's going to be a guest of radio talk show host Michael Smirkanish. He's a moderate conservative who endorsed the president's election bid. Listeners can call in with their questions on the health care plan. Later, the president heads to Democratic Party headquarters for a conference call, an online forum with political supporters and key lawmakers. We'll also be talking health care today. Three Democrats and three Republicans are taking time out of the recess to talk about the overhaul bill.
Just
That's just some of the news that we're watching this morning. As we've been reporting, the people of Afghanistan have voted today in their presidential election. We hear how it's going to come, how it's going, coming up next.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Amy Holmes. I'm here with John Hockenberry. And if you've been listening to The Takeaway, then you know that the Afghans voted today. Polls in Afghanistan are now closed, and now the task of counting ballots in Afghanistan's second ever presidential election is underway. Earlier this morning, we spoke to BBC's Martin Patience, who joined us from Mazar-e-Sharif in northern Afghanistan a few minutes after the polls closed. We asked him to describe what it was like to be there.
We've been here for the last 9 hours. The polls were open since 7 o'clock in the morning, local time, until 4 o'clock, which is the time now. And literally, they've just closed. The policemen who are manning the school gates have shut those gates. So what we've seen here is we've seen about 1,000 people turn up from villages, 3 or 4 villages in the area, to cast their votes. It's been about half-half, half-female, half-male. And I was speaking to one of the officials, and he actually said that there had been a pretty good turnout in this part, in this village, and it seems that there's been a pretty good turnout in the north of the country. Now, that was to be expected in many ways, because the security situation in the north is pretty good, and that's very different from much of the rest of the country.
So, Martin, what was the mood of the voters? Did it seem like something they were excited about in terms of, ratifying the democracy movement in Afghanistan?
Yes, in some ways, I think they did think that. You know, I spoke to one man, he said he was very enthusiastic. It was great to be able to, you know, pick a leader, somebody who was going to lead this country for the next 4 years. But the situation in the north is not reflective of the whole country. If you look at the south and the east of the country, where the insurgency is at its strongest and where the majority of American troops are based, then the Taliban have strongholds there. People will not be turning out in the same numbers as I'm seeing up here in the north today. Many of the voters have been threatened by the Taliban. They've been told that if they go and vote, then they will face reprisals. So the situation is very mixed across the country. As well, I said before, north good, south and east,
sure,
not so good.
Well, Martin Patience, that raises a question. I mean, you're in Mazar-e-Sharif, where, as you say, the turnout seems to be enthusiastic and high. What is the chance that the security situation is going to skew the results? It's believed that Abdullah Abdullah, a major challenger to Hamid Karzai, will run pretty strong where you are. Does that make it more difficult for Hamid Karzai to do well in Taliban-controlled area? And what about the other candidates?
No, I think that's a very good point. If you look at the kind of ethnic breakdown of the country, that's not to say that Afghans vote along ethnic lines, but Dr. Abdullah Abdullah is regarded as a Tajik, and he draws most of his support from the north. President Karzai, who's the other favourite for this election, draws most of his support from the south. So certainly if there's a low turnout in the south and the east of the country, where President Karzai should be getting a lot of votes, then that could well affect his chances in this election. Now, President Karzai is regarded as the front runner. The big question, I think, is President Karzai going to win in the first round, or will this vote go to a second round?
He's got to get more than 50%, and he's even conceded over the last few weeks that the runoff is quite likely. What are people saying there in Mazar-e-Sharif about the Taliban's challenge as you talk to them? Are they concerned about it? Do they feel as though the country is in Afghan hands or is more of an occupation?
Well, what's really interesting about the north is people actually don't talk about security because they've got it. I mean, the situation in the south is completely different. I was down there a month ago in Helmand province, and security was the first thing on everybody's mind. But up here in the north, people are talking about other things. They're talking about economic development. They're talking about progress. I talked to one farmer. He said he wanted a tractor. I talked to a factory owner. He said that he wanted greater protection, economic protection for his goods. So people have moved on here. They're looking to the future, whereas I think people in many parts of the country just want security and they're not thinking about anything else.
So, Martin Patience with the BBC, let's talk about the very right here and now, this very moment. When you look out your window, bring our listeners in. What are you seeing? Are people sort of casually milling about? Are they going back to work? What's your, view?
Well, I'm just in one of the local schools in a village. It's a beautiful village. It's surrounded by fields. And this school is surrounded by a mud wall. There's a big playground. although there's not a lot of grass on it, and it's incredibly bumpy. And just in front of me is the school. There's a few people milling about. They're the election observers. And what you've got is on one side where the men vote, one side of the school, and then the other side, that's where the women vote. And throughout the day, you've been seeing people coming in, traipsing into the school, and then traipsing back out. Most of the women have actually been wearing burqas. The men are mainly farmers. But, you know, it's been very gentle. It's been a very nice scene. It's been very calm, very orderly. It's certainly not been terribly busy, but there has been a steady stream of voters.
So have you
coming to exercise.
Have you seen armed security folks patrolling the school, or has it been fairly open?
No, there is one gate, and at that gate there are two or three policemen. Now, they are armed, and as voters were coming into the polling station, they were being frisked. The women were having to lift up their burqas. That's the head-to-toe garment that many Afghan women wear, and they were being checked as well. So certainly there is a level of security. There's been security at all the polling stations across Afghanistan, but security isn't so much of an issue in the north
right.
of the country
and we've
as
seen,
it is in the south.
We've seen there are security issues that have closed polling stations in Kabul and elsewhere. For a kind of a takeaway image for us, Martin, are people, when they dip their fingers in this ink, are they proudly showing their ink-dipped finger, or are they quickly washing it off and just sort of heading back to their lives?
Well, the idea is you can't wash it off because, obviously, it's designed to stop corruption. So if people are washing it off, I think there'll be real concerns there. But certainly, you know, generally speaking, I think people are engaged in this process where I am. But the situation is different in the south and the east. People, when you get this indelible ink after you've voted, the Taliban have told people that if they catch people with indelible ink in their finger, then they'll chop off their finger. So there's a real... You know, in many parts of the country, people are saying to themselves, you know what, I'm not going to bother voting because it's just simply too dangerous. And I think that's the real concern, that voter turnout in those parts of the country could be low.
That was Martin Patience, BBC correspondent, joining us from Mazar-e-Sharif in northern Afghanistan in an interview we conducted earlier this morning. Now let's check in today's top stories. John, you want to lead us off?
Breaking now, the man convicted of the 1988 airplane bombing over Lockerbie, Scotland, is going free. The nation let him go on humanitarian grounds, citing his terminal cancer. 270 died, including many Americans. The White House says it isn't happy. Neither is Susan Cohen, mother of a victim. We talked to her earlier on The Takeaway.
He's a convicted mass murderer, a terrorist who dropped his appeal. It's so sickening.
Full conversation with Susan Cohen at thetakeaway.org.
Two Korean diplomats are in New Mexico for a second day of meetings with Governor Bill Richardson. Governor Richardson says his meetings showed signs that the reclusive nation may be warming to relations.
So ailing Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy wants the state to replace him quickly if needed. He wants state leaders to change the succession law so that if his seat becomes empty, the governor can appoint an immediate replacement. Kennedy, of course, has brain cancer, although aides say there's been no recent material change in his condition. Wall Street is open and marginally higher. Still ahead on The Takeaway, the email scams aren't what they used to be. We'll talk about how to keep from getting suckered. Some useful information. Just about 10 minutes. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Amy Holmes. So we have explosive new revelations this morning from the New York Times. The paper reports that in 2004, the CIA hired contractors from the security firm Blackwater to find and assassinate top al-Qaeda operatives. It was reportedly never disclosed to lawmakers. With us now is the reporter who's breaking this story, Mark Mazzetti, national security correspondent for the New York Times. Welcome back, Mark. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm finding this incredibly confusing. It seems that initially the CIA said any assassination plans were just on the drawing board. Now you're saying we actually spent millions of taxpayer dollars to hire a private contractor to go out and do it?
Well, there were definitely millions of dollars spent as part of the program. The program in its entirety lasted from about 2002, really up until June, when Leon Panetta, the CIA director, canceled it.
You mean this June of 2009?
That's correct. But there were different phases of the program. The phase that we talk about in today's paper is started around 2004 and lasted, I think, until about 2006, where basically the CIA decided to outsource this, basically hire independent contractors from a company, Blackwater USA, to participate in this program to find, locate, capture, kill senior al-Qaeda operatives.
So, Mark,
throughout
why...
the length of the program, there was never any operations that actually were executed.
I see. So, but why would they outsource this? What was the purpose of that?
Well, they tried to do it on their own from 2002 to 2004, and it never got off the ground. I think the feeling was in the CIA to do it with Blackwater was, first of all, there was more deniability having another company do it. There may have been some cost concerns about would it possibly even be cheaper to outsource. And they figured that they might be able, that there, these outside contractors may have some skills that the that actual CIA operatives didn't have. It's still a little unclear what the thinking was. And certainly Leon Panetta, the CIA director, was, I think, to some extent taken aback when he learned that there was this period of time when they outsourced this this operation.
Well, Mark Mazzetti, the Wall Street Journal broke a story back in July that said that indeed there was a plan to do these kinds of assassinations, but the government officials who spoke on condition of not being identified to the Wall Street Journal said the agency spent money on planning and possibly some training. Is it possible that that's what they're talking about, this money here that was actually given to Blackwater?
I think that when people are talking about the money spent on this program, they're talking about throughout its life. So, yes, there was planning and training during early phases, during the phase that we talked about in today's paper where they outsourced it, and even after they brought it back in-house to the CIA, there was also some planning and training going on. So, yes, there was several million dollars spent, but you know, everyone is on the same page when in agreement that there were no actual operations to kill terrorists as part of the program.
Fascinating, explosive story. Mark Mazzetti, thanks so much for joining us this morning. That was Mark Mazzetti, national security correspondent for the New York Times. The story's in the paper right now. You can go out and buy it and read it. So, John, what do you think about this?
What do you want the outcome to be? That they were successful? They spent millions of dollars and actually were successful in apprehending al-Qaeda? Or that they didn't spend the money? I mean, I guess
I wish they had been trained in-house in the first place.
It just seems that it's all over the map here, that it's kind of outsourced security operations out of anyone's oversight or control.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. So our weekly tech segment is technically about email scams, but it may be more about your personal anti-sucker software. How gullible are you? We'll find out. First, let's take a look at some of today's top stories. Amy?
The man convicted in the 1998 Lockerbie plane bombing is now free and headed for a Libya-bound plane. A BBC reporter told us earlier that Gaddafi may have sent the plane himself. The White House says it is, quote, it deeply regrets Scotland's release of the bomber. The release is on humanitarian grounds. The man has terminal cancer. 270 died in the explosion. Polls are now closed in Afghanistan after voting was extended by an hour. Counting is now underway, which will take some time.
So the fresh numbers are out this morning on the job market. 576,000 Americans filed new unemployment claims last month. It's been moving the markets, 15,000 higher than expected. And Wall Street opened slightly lower this morning, although it seems to have recovered at this point. The White House goes talk radio today. Moderate conservative host Michael Smirkanish is going to do his show with the president. He endorsed him in the election, and there will be listener questions.
In the Atlantic, Hurricane Bill has weakened slightly to a Category 3 storm, but forecasters say it could again gain strength. Those are some of the top stories we're following this morning.
So our tech segment this morning is skewing very low tech, folk, as in there's a sucker born every minute. P.T. Barnum said that back in the 19th century. In the 21st century, it could be a nanosecond a sucker is born every nanosecond. But the deal is the same. Computers now are a window into the vulnerable, the gullible people who can't resist a come on like this. Let me start by introducing myself properly. I am Mr. Tijani Yusufi, credit officer with the Union Bank of Nigeria PLC Benin branch. I came to know of you in my private search for a reliable and reputable person to handle this confidential transaction, which involves transferring huge sum of money. Am I getting it? Am I getting it? Huh? To a foreign account requiring maximum confidence. Tempted yet? Want to hit that return key? Well, the almost cliche tortured English of these so-called 419 scams, named for a Nigerian anti-fraud law. Mostly these scammers work in email. But the newest twist now is scamming in Craigslist and other social networking platforms. They're familiar, but there's a new mechanism, a new twist. Joining us now is Jackie Chang, associate editor of the tech news site Ars Technica via WBEZ, public radio station in Chicago. Good morning, Jackie.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Ryan LaBarge joins us from Ann Arbor, Michigan. He was nearly scammed by a Craigslist housing scammer. Good morning, Ryan.
Good morning.
And right here in the studio is Amir Orad, executive vice president of the anti-fraud firm Actimize. He's also an expert on financial crime and cybersecurity. Amir, good morning.
Good morning.
Was I tempting you there with my Nigerian scam voice there?
Yeah.
What is it that makes this a tech story? Because it seems to me that if you fall for something like this, you really need to have your head examined.
Well, the issue is, you know, we have so many emails that you can send in one click of a button. They're just easy to do it. And if you send it to enough people, one of them will be naive enough to click the button.
What is it, Jackie Chang, about the emails and the use of Craigslist in this particular case and other social networking sites that makes these kinds of scams more possible to actually result in a few thousand up to maybe $10,000-$20,000 being scammed out of people?
Well, using Craigslist means that you get to reach, you know, that many more people. Email is of course, you know, a great way to spam, you know, millions of people at once. But Craigslist, if you put an ad on Craigslist, you get a lot of responses, or you might spam Craigslist like real people's listings, you know, to try and get a bite.
Ryan LaBarge, I don't want to disparage the fact that you were nearly scammed by a Craigslist housing scammer, but it does seem to me that there's something about browsing on the web and going through email where a line or a couple of words grabs your attention and suddenly your wallet opens up. What happened with you?
Yeah, it's really all about anonymity. Somebody tried to scam me on Craigslist. I was looking for a new place to rent after my lease was going up. And it was just a really good offer in a nice place of town, and I tried to get some information about it, and the person at first seemed legit, then kind of led me on more and more. I kind of got the idea I was being scammed.
So, Ryan, this is Amy Holmes here. Is the problem or potentially the vulnerability with Craigslist, though, is that there are legitimate things on Craigslist? So how do you sort between them?
Oh, right, absolutely. It was a legitimate home at a correct address. The pictures were correct. It looks like somebody just went on Craigslist when somebody else was trying to rent out that house and just took it over. But I think the thing that makes these new and fresh is it's just a different attack vector than what you normally expect in email.
Amir, let's talk about the modality here. I mean, it's a classic scam, and it really goes back to, you know, it goes back thousands of years, really. You basically, to get a huge amount of money, give me a smaller amount of money, and I'll help you get this huge amount of money, and before you know it, you're out $20,000 in maybe increments of $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 at a time. What is it that gets people to hit the send button and actually disclose financial information or actually send money?
So for some reason, people trust the written word much more. So if some guy walks down the street with a chain of keys and telling you, I'll give you this house I have for $10,000, you'll never do it. But for some reason, if it's online, nice pictures, looks real, you're more likely to believe it, the written word.
But even though the grammar is wrong, a reliable and reputable person to handle this confidential transaction, which involves huge sum of money to foreign account, that's not a clue? That's
true. And all caps, by the way.
Yeah. So there are actually some very good ones. This nanny I know just got a job offer downtown, and she got prepaid the first check, $5,000. And after they paid her the check, they asked to get the fee in return, $1,000 from it. Now, the issue is once you deposit the check, it will bounce. But you already paid $1,000 and it's too late.
So it's all about getting you involved in certain sort of phantom transactions, but one of them is suddenly taking money from you. That's Amir Arad, executive vice president of the anti-fraud firm Actimize. Jackie Chang, associate editor of Ars Technica. What are investigators doing to prevent this sort of thing, or is there really little that can be done?
Well, I think the biggest push is education. So, the FBI put out a notice about a month ago that housing scams were growing on Craigslist, and you know, it's more about just making the public aware of what's going on, because, you know, this kind of thing happens so much and there's so much email and Craigslist listings going up that it's kind of hard to stay on top of every single thing. And I do know that a number of people who have been scammed have reported it to the FBI and that kind of thing. And they are, you know, trying their best to help those people out. But I think the first line of attack is definitely education.
So, Jackie, in the interest of educating our listeners, what exactly is the scam? You go on Craigslist, you want to buy, rent a house. What happens next?
There are actually two sides to this. Nigerian scammers, or 419 scammers, have been making listings for houses for rent, you know, either to actually live in, you know, for the next year, or, you know, for vacation houses. And they're hoping that people will respond and communicate with them over email. You know, and then the story is, oh, I had to move, I had to go to UK, I had to go to Africa, and I want someone to watch over the house. And so you, as the renter, you know, they kind of suck you in, because they make you feel like they have, you know, this confidence in you that you're going to take care of their beloved house. And they want you to send them your, you know, like security deposit to Nigeria or whatever. And of course, the idea is that, you know, they don't actually really own the house, and, you know, they're just going to run off with your security deposit and you're not going to have a place to live.
Sure. Well, Ryan LaBarge, how do you sort out what is a fake, a fraudulent offer for an exchange of real estate? Because it's a huge business online. The legitimate business is huge.
Yeah, it's really huge. There's Craigslist, and there's so many different other websites that you can get these listings on for free, or, you know, for low cost. So there's plenty of opportunity for these people to do that. And it really just comes down. Nobody's trying to. There's no such thing as a free lunch.
Thank you, Ryan. Thanks for that. Our tech segment today: no such thing as a free lunch.
That's
Ryan,
the takeaway.
Ryan LaBarge, nearly scammed by a Craigslist housing scammer. Nobody's going to be pulling the wool over his eyes. Jackie Cheng was also with us, associate editor of the tech news site Ars Technica, and Amir Arad, executive vice president of the anti-fraud firm Actimize, and an expert on financial crime and cybersecurity, who says, trust no one.
Well, John, we're also talking about legitimate business ventures. Some people, they have the courage to start a business venture in a recession, and they're not the first to do it. Revlon started in tough economic times, as you were telling us, as did Fortune magazine.
Those little outfits.
We want to ask you, what's the opportunity in a recession? When have you taken a risk despite tough odds?
Hi, my name is Susie Gallahue. I started a new jewelry line about a year ago called Susanna Day because I lost my dog, and it's done really well so far. I've been picked up by stores like Bergdorf Goodman, Takashimaya. Starting new business in a recession, it hasn't been easy, but it's a lot better than what I was doing before.
Bergdorf Goodman, that's pretty
great.
Impressive.
Not bad.
Give us a call. Please tell us your take at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or email at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And if you missed anything, we're always at thetakeaway.org. Take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at takeaway.org or on iTunes.
And you can see Susie's jewelry. Go to our website, thetakeaway.org. There'll be a link on there. You can see what she's actually done during this recession. I'm John Hockenberry.
And we have very entrepreneurial listeners.
Indeed.
I'm Amy Holmes.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.